Science is interesting, and if you don't agree, you can fuck off.
All right, science it is. So, first topic, maybe, with Marcus today. Oh, yeah. I don't know if we should redo a small introduction of Marcus Jones, who's covering for Alan. Do you want to have a little chat about yourself?
About me? Really? Yes. I'm not that interesting, really. I've been in New Zealand for, what, about 3 months now?
Okay.
Came over from the States. Been there for, I don't know, 17 years or something, working in various places in the States. And obviously, as you can probably tell by my accent, I'm not from there originally. I'm from the UK. Hopefully New Zealand's where I'm going to be for now on.
All right. Yeah. Good. Good to know that you're liking it here. So we're here to talk about science. So let's get on with it because we have a very limited amount of time. And first you wanted to talk about this air leak that was caused by a meteorite strike at the International Space Station. So what happened?
Well, that's a good question. So, as you may have heard already, there was a bit of a problem in the ISS this week, where they discovered the air pressure was going down, and they found a little hole. So they opened and closed various hatches or doors, I guess, in the ISS, mm-hmm. and figured out where it was. There's six people in space right now. Six people up there.
Yes.
Three Americans, two Russians, and a German, and they found, I don't know which one of them found the hole, but it was a 2 millimeter hole they found in the outside of the spaceship.
So that sounds really small, but how dangerous is it?
Well, from what I read, if they didn't do anything, they would lose all their air in 18 days, which doesn't sound that bad to me. Presumably they'd be long dead before that happened.
Yes, probably. Right.
But it gave them a bit of time, I guess, to patch it up, patch the leak. And so what was interesting is the guy who found it just put his thumb over it and stopped it, which seems to be the logical thing to do.
Yeah, handy. But,
and then they used duct tape because duct tape is useful for absolutely everything, including patching holes in spacecraft.
Yep.
and filled it. But there's a couple of sort of interesting things to do with this. So did a little bit of reading. Since the 50s, there's been thousands and thousands of space launches, and you know there are more than 20,000 objects that are floating around or orbiting mm-hmm. the planet that are currently being tracked. That's the things that we know of.
Yes.
And those are, about 1,000 of those are satellites that mm-hmm. are working and doing their job and letting us know with GPS and things like that and communications. But a lot of the other pieces, or the vast majority of other things, are small bits of satellites that have either broken up or exploded or whatever. And these things are traveling, you know, nearly 30,000 kilometers an hour. So that's pretty fast. And that's a lot faster than a bullet. And so you don't need a big thing to make a big hole.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so this thing was obviously, must have been less than 2 millimeters in diameter, but it went straight through.
And it could have caused all these six people to die had they not found the leak.
Had they not found the leak, and also had someone been standing where it was going to hit the spacecraft, then presumably he would have been, or she would have been in trouble. So that's a problem. So there's a lot of space debris floating around the planet. And there's been a few proposals to what to do to pick it all up. So various proposals, but the University of Surrey in the UK, they proposed a little small spacecraft that would deploy a CubeSat, a little satellite which would unfurl a net that could potentially sort of gather up all of this space debris or some of this space debris.
And so it's like a little garbage bin just floating around and
like trash disposal.
Yeah.
And then presumably
Well, would it be that it sort of like catches it as it just roams around and just catches random stuff?
I think so. Yeah. I mean, I'm not sure how they would do it, but
that's the idea.
But there's some controversy.
Okay.
I didn't know about this when I first heard the story, but it turns out the Russian Space Agency chief said this wasn't a meteorite.
Okay.
And what it could have been is someone made a mistake on when the part of the ISS was being made
mm-hmm.
and accidentally drilled a hole.
Oh, that would
and filled it, because they could see if you look at the picture where the hole was, it looks like they started drilling a few different places and then drilled a little 2 millimeter hole.
Wouldn't they have checked that before it went up to space?
You'd think so, but it must have been filled with some sort of filler that maybe degraded or something like that, and then popped out.
But degraded, don't they spend like a lot of money on this kind of stuff? You know, wouldn't they?
Not to disparage the Russians, but this was a Russian satellite or a Russian part of the ISS.
But I suppose it also just comes down to human error. You know, if you're going to have humans working on such things and then humans controlling it, then surely there's a part of error factor there that you wish wasn't there, but probably is.
It probably is. And the thing is, if a meteorite hit one part of the ISS and it was traveling at 30,000 kilometers an hour, it's either in the ISS because there wasn't a hole on the other side, or it would have gone straight through. So presumably if they didn't find the little
then
meteorite
just,
inside,
then
it's something else.
So
he mentioned that. He also said that they couldn't rule out that an astronaut
had
actually sort of in some desperate state had
sabotage?
Decided to sabotage the ISS. Oh,
that's an interesting theory.
The Russians or the Americans?
The Americans. The Russians don't want it to be said that they messed up the International Space Station or the whatever, you know. Just like, no. Anyway, moving on to the next topic is daylight saving, which is actually coming up in, I guess, a month and a half or so in New Zealand-ish. I don't know. Late October, I think.
I'm new here. I don't know.
I think it's about a week or two delayed from Europe. And so you're saying that some people, there's more and more people in Europe that are supporting putting an end to daylight savings.
Yeah.
I first wanted to ask, why is it that we have daylight savings in the first place and how does it work?
Well, I think you should know all this already because apparently, and I didn't know this, it was a Kiwi in the 19th century that proposed putting the clocks forward every year.
Okay.
A guy called George Hudson in 1895. He was an entomologist, liked to study insects, and he, after his day job, I guess, he went out in the evening and ran after his butterflies.
He wanted to do it in daylight.
He wanted to do it in daylight, yeah. So he wanted the clocks to go back. Which
fair enough, Cole.
Was a sweet thing to do. So he proposed this, but unfortunately the New Zealand government said no. And apparently it was the Germans who decided to do it in World War One. They wanted to conserve coal, so it was a way of the thought of saving energy.
Yeah, I thought that was always linked to energy savings.
Yeah. So the Germans did it first during the war. Britain followed, Russia followed, and then the US a year or two later. And then it's been on and off in many countries since then. And there's people on both sides. Some people like it, some people don't, and there's good reasons to support either way, I think. But and actually, I'm just going back. I'm glad you said daylight saving. I've been instructed, because I always used to say daylight savings, and I've instructed to say daylight savings is wrong.
Okay.
Apparently you're supposed to say daylight saving.
Why the difference?
I have no idea.
Okay.
Apparently this causes some controversy too, I don't know.
Oh, that's good. I thought I was mispronouncing it, but apparently I was right.
So there's been a big survey across the EU, and 84% of the people who responded, and that is only about 5 million out of 500 million, but anyway, 84% of those decided that they were against changing their clocks.
Okay.
And they wanted to keep the same time all year round, whether that is the time in summertime or the time in wintertime, I don't know. But one of those times they'll pick, I guess.
Yes.
And you can... Europe's all about coordinating things across the whole of Europe, with the exception of Britain now, but whatever. and it makes sense that all the countries in Europe change their clocks at the same time, you know, because otherwise it'll cause more expense and difficulties in trade and that sort of thing. And it makes more sense for some countries than others. So if you are in, say, the south of Italy or south of Spain or something like that, well, there's not as big a change in the seasons as if you're in Norway or Sweden or Finland or something like that.
Yeah.
And so parts of Europe, they don't really care, or it doesn't really have much of an effect. And other parts, it's a pretty big deal. And So they're looking into this, and they have to coordinate it, and knowing EU politics, it will take about 15 yes. years before anything gets done.
Most definitely.
but there's arguments for and against, and I don't know where either of you, maybe you could tell me where you stand on this, or whether you really care.
Yeah, so I grew up in France, so in Europe,
yeah.
And I suppose it doesn't make that much of a difference. I think it's pretty much like what it is like in New Zealand. So it's just you go back or you go forward, and it makes a difference on the day that it happens. Obviously, you're like, oh, I wake up and it's dark, or I wake up and it's light. And then, but because it's just an hour difference, it doesn't actually has that big of an impact on us. I think whether it's for energy consumption or anything else, it's yeah. pretty much the same. I guess you just acclimatize within the week. Mm. But I can see why in certain countries that would make quite a drastic difference. But I don't know. I remember going to Budapest, which is also in Europe, and it was in May, and the sun was rising at 4 a.m, which was really early. And I could see why they probably would like to have, I don't know, a different...
move it forward
a bit. Yeah, move it forward a bit, because, I don't know, 4 a.m., walking up by bright sunlight, it's a bit tough even for me. I was out partying, and I was like, oh, 4 o'clock daytime, what's going on? So that was pretty weird. But I suppose that's what you're saying, though, is Europe's quite a vast entity.
Yeah,
and
I mean, I grew
situations
up
are different.
I grew up in the north of England, and in the middle of winter it would be dark when I got to school, and it would be dark when I finished school.
Yeah.
And you know, an extra hour of daylight once we were out of school would have been, you know,
yeah.
a bit of fun.
I know, there's nothing more depressing than, you know, you yeah. spent your awake time is spent literally
in darkness.
And yeah.
yeah. When you're not in work or not in school.
Yeah, well then you're like inside, and then the second yeah. you step outside it's dark. It's yeah. that's a bit sad. I don't know. I think that's part of winter, though, isn't it? Like that's one of the things that you expect with winter.
I don't know. I mean, living in New Zealand, I guess we don't really experience that. And if we've never, like, had that, like, seen that in Europe as well, I don't know if it affect us that much.
Yeah.
All right, let's talk about the final topic, which is, a bit more specifically, technically scientific, which is salt.
Technically scientific, yes.
yeah. I don't know, that didn't really make sense. It made sense in my head. What I meant is, so the story is that we have difficulty finding an adequate substitute for salt. Why is that?
Good question. And I don't know the full story. I don't know the full full answer to that question. But so we know salt is bad for you if you eat lots of it. And you can lead to hypertension, you know, and high blood pressure and things. And so people like to encourage, government and health people like to encourage you to stop eating so much salt.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is, unlike sugar, you know, the sugar is, you know, bad for you in high quantities, but there's alternatives to sugar that sort of taste sweet and people get away with. But with salt, there isn't really the same alternative. Mm. So salt is sodium chloride, just a sodium and a chloride atom, but the alternatives, are, sort of the main alternative has been potassium chloride, which tastes salty, but there's also a bitter taste. Some people say it tastes a bit metallic.
Okay.
So it's not really a great substitute. And so finding a substitute without the health risks of salt, but with the taste of salt is actually quite challenging. The difficulty, I think, comes from the way that salt is sensed.
Okay.
So, do you know how many fundamental tastes there are?
I know, but I'll let you guys know.
No, I have no
4.
Clue.
No, there's 5 apparently.
5? I thought there was 4.
I thought there was 4.
It was like sweet.
Not.
Wait, there's sour, bitter.
Yep.
Sweet and umami, which is like savory, I guess, like salty,
yeah,
pretty much.
But then there's salt on top of that.
Okay, so that's a different one.
So that is different. Oh. Apparently. So umami, I think, is the most recently defined one, but it's recognized as a separate taste sensation. It's got its own receptors,
okay.
Which are distinct from that of salt or sweet or the others.
All right.
And I think most of them are pretty well understood, but salt, there's a sort of a different mechanism. Instead of so there's various proteins that are that respond to sweet flavors and to bitter flavors and things like that. But salt There are these ion channels in your body, and there's many pathways that underlie this saltiness that you sense. And I think so. I'm probably going to butcher the name, but there's called amylaride sensitive and amylaride insensitive.
Okay.
And I'm sure that's wrong, but pathways, two different pathways, and okay. one is operates at low salt concentrations.
Mm-hmm.
So you know when you add a little bit of salt to food, I guess it enhances the flavor and blah blah blah.
Yeah.
And I guess that's that pathway. And then when you have a lot of salt, then there's a different pathway that is activated.
Okay.
And I think it's this complexity that makes it difficult to find a substitute to salt. So the one thing that has been done, you can buy something with low salt. Yeah.
Okay, yes.
And just remove the salt. But then people say, oh, it doesn't taste as good.
Yeah.
Or you can use more herbs or garlic or whatever and put in different flavors instead.
Yeah.
But a more realistic idea, instead of developing a substitute, you develop an enhancer, something that enhances the flavor of salt. So maybe you only need a small amount of salt for the same effect.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So what do we think about?
Well, one possible, which I just learned about, is MSG.
Oh.
Yeah, which is...
Isn't that bad, though?
Yeah, people in huge amounts, it's probably bad for you, but most things in huge amounts are. But in small amounts, I think it's perfectly healthy, but that might be controversial, so
okay.
Watch your email. what it does is it enhances the flavor of salt.
Okay, so yeah.
If you have a bit of MSG in your food...
Mm-hmm. And a little bit of salt...
Then the salt is sort of magnified, I guess.
Okay,
yeah.
So that's one thing we can look at.
Yeah, and then you don't get high blood pressure.
Good.
Which is good.
Yes, I think it is a good thing. Okay. All right, well, it's time for us to... stop talking about science, unfortunately. But we will be back next week to talk about science a bit more and with Marcus again. So thanks for coming today.
Pleasure.
Thanks for the enlightenment. And we'll see you next week.
Yeah, see you then.
All right, cheers.
That was Dear Science.